Well, good afternoon, everybody who may be listening to us. I guess I interrupted the music. Anyway, my name is David Payton, and I'm the guy who wrote that book that I hope you're going to read, called Second Sight, Views from an Eye Doctor's Odyssey. And I had a lot of fun in life, and some of that I'd like to try to share with you today, along with my two guests. But also, it's a serious book in a lot of ways. It's been called Layered. I love that. Layered. And that means, I guess, that it has something more than just anecdotal stuff. But here, my first obligation now is to introduce our two guests. And the first is Dr. Larry Schwab. He's one of the most noted persons in global ophthalmology. That means eye care around the world. Eyes care of ophthalmology. Global ophthalmology of anybody. He's published and republished his very classic book, which is called Eye Care in Developing Nations, and it's now in its fourth edition, and it's printed in English and three other languages. It's probably soon to go into a fifth edition. I'll have to ask him about that. But, it's of almost biblical importance, but maybe biblical is a bad word because that sort of sounds very stationary. And in this case, Dr. Schwab updates his book as science changes it, and in accordance with whatever the new information is for helping the people with eye troubles in the developing nations. And he first got interested in working in developing nations, I believe, actually, from some work in Vietnam and some things that happened to him in Vietnam. He may be willing to tell us about that a little later. But in 1972, after finishing training as an eye doctor, he and his wife, his children, went to what's called, I guess I call, Darkest Africa, because remember Stanley and Livingston, who met in Darkest Africa. That was his term, Stanley's term, I think. And it's a very adventuresome feeling it is. But Dr. Schwab was in Malawi and Zimbabwe. And first he'd been in Ethiopia and Kenya, and then Malawi and Zimbabwe. So by the 1980s, he'd been 12 years in this wonderful, extraordinary commitment to the health and caring for people in those developing nations. And I want to say that Dr. Schwab comes into my book in a very important way, and he is essentially the conscience and veritable heart of the indigent people who he has cared for, and that played a great role, although unknowingly, in my own life, which I point out in the latter part of my book. So that's Dr. Schwab, and Dr. Schwab, hello.
Hello, David. I'm pleased to join you, and thank you so much for inviting me to join you on this blog.
Well, it's such an honor to have you, and I want to say more about you in a little while. But the other person is Ms. Patricia Dahl, and Pat Dahl is another old friend of mine. She's the CEO and executive director of the Eye Bank for Sight Restoration in Manhattan. And it just happens that that's the original eye bank of the whole world, and it was founded by my father, the eye doctor, Townley Payton. And so Pat's eye bank is very special to me, and Pat is special also because of her 31 years in eye banking. There's another Pat in eye banking who's the head of the Eye Bank Association of America, and that's Pat Aiken O'Neill. So, and she's a lawyer as well. Anyway, I'm not getting into, but she's a very dear person as well and very qualified. But today we're dealing with this other wonderful person, Pat Dahl, whose experience is so vast. One of my greatest interests have been corneal transplants, and corneal transplants really are not possible without the availability of an eye bank. So, Pat, thank you for coming on board, and I hope we can count on you to tell us about your eye bank and about some of the things that have occurred in recent years that have allowed this eye banking to evolve into an ever more efficient system. Hi, Pat.
Hi, David. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the honor of being included.
Thank you for being here. Well, I was just wondering, just to start on some of the information I want to squeeze out of you, what is the volume of are corneas that are collected in the United States these days, and how much of those are sent overseas? Many of them, or is that just a small minority?
The statistics for the iBank Association of America, last year almost 60,000 corneas were collected, and just a little bit over 42,000 were transplanted in the U.S. And so the remaining portion were provided to individuals throughout the rest of the world. It's fantastic that we have a supply of donor tissue in the U.S. Pretty much the waiting time, when I first started in 1981, the waiting time in New York was a month and a half, almost 2 months long. And now it's 2 weeks at the very most. And that most of that is because of the surgeon's own schedule and being able to figure out, you know, where they're going to be and how they can assign all their patients to their scheduled surgery day.
To stress the importance of the eye banking, just say that you can only do a corneal transplant with another human cornea. You can't use animals. They have all been tried. I've tried some of them myself. And nothing works except human cornea, and it has to be living tissue.
Right.
Sorry, Pat, I didn't interrupt you.
But no, that's quite right. And so that the time from death to removal is about 12 hours, and from death to the cornea being transplanted in the U.S. is about 5 to 7 days. Outside of the U.S., the time is extended to what the manufacturer, the preservation media allows, up to 14 days. But since we have enough tissue here in a timely manner, the tissue is typically transplanted in 5 days.
Some people get upset when they hear that some American corneas go abroad, but I think you'd immediately say that really only happens if the deadline is approaching of their usefulness, and they're in tremendous demand abroad. And so if they can't be used here and they've been, quote, harvested, end quote, it's better to send them over there. And in my book, I've told some stories about that, of importing those corneas from the United States. I was, in fact, Larry Schwab and I both started our independent careers, I should say independent, working independently in our different places, I in Jordan and he in Ethiopia, under the auspices of the International Eye Foundation, which is one of the non-governmental organizations that was in existence then as a young organization and now is one of the important ones. And there are about 24 eye organizations or NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and the Eye Bank, of course, is a very important component of that, even though the main reason I want listeners to know, the main cause of curable blindness in this world is a cataract, and cataracts are simply removed from an eye. A cornea has to be transplanted if there's a bad cornea. So they are very, comparatively speaking, cataract surgery is far more important just for the very huge volume of people who require it than corneal surgery. But in some places, like in Iran in the old days and in Saudi Arabia and all throughout the Middle East, see people in the streets with white surfaces of their eyes, and those people, if they have any chance of having vision restored, if they're blind, is by corneal transplant. I didn't mean to just rattle on about this. Larry, do you have any comments about that? Have you been more focused on the importance of volume of people cured rather than spending time and expense on a few people, because a corneal transplant requires a great deal more equipment and, of course, human tissue and so on?
Yes. From a public health perspective, with limited resources, cataract surgery, cataract removal, and now with the current technology being very affordable for intraocular lens implantation, that is the insertion of an artificial lens that's clear after removing the cataract, which is a human lens that has merely grown cloudy, the cost of that has come down significantly in many poor countries. And from a public health perspective, you get a bigger bang for your buck, so to speak. But that it can't be denied that anyone who is blind from a corneal opacity, and especially in both eyes, that if the indications are such that that person could benefit from a corneal transplant, that from a humanitarian basis, it would be improper, of course, to deny that person the opportunity.
Sure.
The problem, of as you've already alluded to, is in many countries, human tissue is simply not available, and the need is much greater than the supply. And that's where Pat Dahl and the iBanking services from the United States serve an enormous role in reversing corneal blindness. But from the perspective of diverting resources to corneal transplant over a more effective public health strategy, from a public health point of view, is it's not as effective as cataract surgery, which is one of the most effective operations in restoring lifestyle on a large scale and restoring vision to human that has ever been developed.
But let me just put in a word for corneal transplant just for a minute, just because my father started the first eye bank, and the way, and in this country at that time, in the 1940s, nobody wanted to give their eyes, the eyes from the dead of their family and so on. It was a very spooky thought. So what he figured out was there were people being executed at Sing Sing, the prison up the river from where he was working in New York, and he got permission from those prisoners to use their eyes, their corneas, after their death, and so he'd go way up the river and bring them back and keep them in our ice box overnight, and it led to some screams in the morning by some of the people who saw them, but they then took them off to the hospital and would use them for corneal transplants. Similarly, in the country, the developing countries, there's very little cooperation with getting donor tissue over there, is particularly, I should say, in the Islamic countries. And yet, even though after spending 2 years there, we never really got a voluntary, contribution of corneas. We did hundreds, if not thousands, of corneal transplants with the entire staff of this hospital in Riyadh, all of which were imported from France, Japan, United States, England, and there has never been a Muslim that I know of who's refused a cornea, even though he may not yet have the sensitivities to realize that he should be on the donor end of it as well. And that's just a question of education and awareness of what eye banking is and so on. But it has been one of the challenges of doing corneal surgery in developing nations, and that's why I wanted to interrupt and to say that. But let me go back to cataracts again, because, Larry, that really is a matter of enormous importance. I think I may be wrong at saying something like this, but you correct me. I think there's something like 30 million people in this world who could have their vision restored by cataract surgery, their blindness reversed, if they could have access to a cataract extraction doctor, if a doctor would do it. Is that approximately right?
It depends on how you define blindness from a cataract.
Yeah.
The U.S. definition is more liberal than the WHO measurement of blindness. But anyone whose lifestyle is impaired, of course, it doesn't matter what the visual acuity measurement is, if they cannot carry on their basic functions in the poorest of countries, they're a loss to the microeconomy and to the family. Yes, there are literally millions. The exact number is not known, but there are some guesses and some very good estimates based on prevalent surveys in countries. The key fact is that in the developing world, in the poorest countries, the non-industrialized nations, 90% of all the blindness in the world occurs in those countries, and 80% of it is either reversible in the case of doing cataract surgery, or it's preventable in the case of treating people with trachoma in areas where it occurs to the extent that it can cause blindness.
Trachoma being an infectious disease and glaucoma being a pressure, eye pressure problem. But that's also often preventable.
And that's preventable also. And also, of course, emerging on the scene is blindness from diabetes, which is now becoming not just an epidemic in the United States and North America, but throughout the world. In the more affluent people, even in the poorest countries, if they're not educated to the effects of diabetes, can not only have their lifespan shortened, but also suffer the debilitating effects, including retinal disease from bleeding and eventual blindness if it's not treated. So this is another area in which I think ophthalmology worldwide and preventable programs that prevent eye disease and teach healthcare workers to recognize and to refer those with diabetes that need
to I'm going to interrupt you for a minute because suddenly I think that I'm thinking about a lot of people who may be listening who are saying, well, why are these doctors telling us all this stuff about technical stuff? We just give us the overview. And I do want to say an overview because here, selfishly, I'm coming back to my book, Second Sight, because one of the things that I felt most challenging in the 1940s was to figure out how can we teach our colleagues around the world how to do proper cataract surgery in a manner that is efficient and effective and so on. And we were just learning in the late 1940s, 50s, and 60s that there was a new technique of small incision cataract surgery where you could just do a little teeny bit incision, just like you can do this laparoscopic surgery on knees and tummies and whatever. And they needed a way of teaching that, and so that led to the invention or conception of Orbis, which was then a DC-8. And that was the most colossal undertaking of my life to try to help get together the wherewithal that would require, because it was really a harebrained idea. And the bottom line is that by 1982, it took that much time, it flew. And when it flew, it became immediately popular with doctors all around the world, wherever we went. It's been to 88 countries now, and they claim that it's saved millions of eyes from being blind. But I don't know, aside from the data, it certainly has been popular. But it also, here's the thing, a lot of people don't realize that that's a teaching machine, and that's why it is. One can excuse the expense of a large aircraft going around the world, and obviously use of much fuel, all of which is donated, and all the equipment is donated. And yet there are some things about it that are also very troubling, because we went with microscopes and other very fancy instruments to darkest Africa again, like where Larry was. And sometimes, unfortunately, we sometimes use the bravado of the aircraft unconsciously to the pleasure of those who watched it, but really in an unjustified manner. And I got into a cross purposes about that, and I was not allowed back with Orbis after a while, and I have returned to it since. It's just a wonderful organization, and they're about to have now a third aircraft. And to me, it's one of the fundamental things for what we're growing to call global ophthalmology, and that is it has so many teaching functions, so much familiarity, so much eye recognition, that I hope it's been a significant contribution. And Pat, you probably send a lot of corneas to the cornea people, or to the Orbis people, isn't that true?
I know that eye banks throughout the U.S. do provide corneas for the Orbis drips, and I know that eye bankers themselves have gone as well to help start eye banks in those various areas, and many of them have been quite successful. There is a continual need, absolutely, in the developing world for the advances in eye banking. We have, as you said, the iBank for Sight Restoration is the world's first iBank, and we've been the grateful recipients of many visitors from various parts of the world who have come to see this original iBank. I think some of them might think that, you know, we're going to be housed in some, you know, brownstone in the Upper East Side or something, but now we're down on Wall Street, so I hope they're not disappointed when they come see us. But we've been very proud to be able to offer them our insight. And of late, we created a marketing program to increase awareness about donation. It's something that I think can be transferable to other parts of the world, just as you mentioned in your book about starting Orbis and the difficulties you had with getting people to help you with funding and even getting your efforts to start the iBank in Jordan and getting permission from the authorities. And it all comes down to education.
Yeah, I was almost thrown out of Jordan if anything worse might have happened than that. They could have because I was accused of stealing eyes because there was a Catholic nun that was calling me at night and saying, come on down to the old city, and a child in our hospital has died, and you can have the corneas, but better hurry because the authorities will be here, and blah, blah, blah. And so I did. I'd go down with a black box at midnight, furtively go down and obtain donor tissue in that manner, and sew them into eyes in the morning, and it was really very successful because what better way of getting donor eyes? But a lot of the people, the mullahs and others, felt that was a terrible thing, and I'll spare you the details of the story, but basically it was through the kindness of King Hussein, the wonderful, inspiring man who intervened and saved me from being exported and very much embarrassed by what I was doing. I have had a lot of experiences I've been on the fringe of misfortune and over again, and I can't seem to give it up. One gets a wanderlust. I think maybe to some extent, Larry, you might agree with this. There's something about, no matter how uncomfortable it may be, how many primitive one's life may be, there's something very compelling about participation in different cultures and in understanding them, and to feel as a Westerner that you can be helpful to them. And there's something sustaining about that. It never leaves you once you've had its privilege. It's just like being an eye doctor and being a part of restoring sight to somebody who's been completely blind, and they can see, and even though you're sort of an experienced old doctor, you've done thousands of those, you never get over the excitement of that. I don't want to say it too much, too excited, because anybody who's in training now in medicine, they're going to want to go into ophthalmology, which is the only sensible thing to do. But I must admit there's other medical disciplines that need their help. And so I don't want to speak too highly, but I think the biggest the most well-kept secret is the delight that eye doctors have in the rewards of their work, the emotional reward. That's the way it's been for me. And Larry, have you felt that at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. David, I have. And that was the reason, really, in 1972 when I completed my residency, I'd always felt a calling, not on a religious basis or for pecuniary reasons, but I just felt a need to go to Africa because I'd always been interested in impoverished populations, and I knew a little bit about the need in poor countries, and I went without further training in public health, and I didn't have any experience academically, but soon learned firsthand the need for it. For the listeners of this broadcast too, I want to recommend Dr. David Payton's book just at the highest level, Odyssey, Second Sight. It is an extraordinary book. It was one of those compelling books, even though I've known David Payton for many years, it was one that I couldn't put down. It read as a contemporary historical novel, and the stories are not only entertaining, but they're true. And what he expresses about the gratification of serving in a needful area is enough to keep you going sometimes it's discouraging when there's electricity and the main lines go out or you don't have fresh water. You improvise. Because in the sub-Saharan African region where we spent all those years, there was only one person in 10 who ever received sight-restoring cataract surgery. And the ratio of trained ophthalmologists up to the training that ophthalmologists receive here and are board certified, there was only one of those for every 1 million people in sub-Saharan Africa. So the need was there. You could do cataract surgery only and never complete the list. So the idea was to train ophthalmologists and medical assistants, nurses and ophthalmic nurses and clinical officers to recognize and treat eye disease when ophthalmologists were not present, to extend our services. So a lot of my role was teaching and training non-physicians within the context of the government guidelines in medical and surgical eye care training.
No, Larry, and thank you for those kind remarks. Let me pick up though one other thing too about Orbis, because and that is the word volunteers. Orbis was taught and still is taught in large measure by American or other Western ophthalmologists teaching the ingenuities of modern day ophthalmology on board the aircraft with all of its audiovisual facilities and so on. And they come there as volunteers. They give up time in their office to spend 2 weeks or 3 weeks or more just working in a developing country. And similarly, there are land-based operations all over the place, and ophthalmologists, I think, are among the very best of people who give their time. Volunteerism in our specialty is tremendous, and it's based partly on what you and I said, Larry, you and I said about the excitement and privilege that the doctor has in doing sight-saving things. But interestingly, I think medicine doesn't get fair share of credit for all of the volunteerism that happens throughout medicine and other parts, and also in what's done free of charge. For example, in eye banking, although charges are made for the tissue in its preparation and transportation these days, you don't actually buy eye tissue, and it would go free of charge were it not for the expense of the technical work of preparing the tissue or preserving it and then delivering it. But work without charge, non-profit work by non-governmental organizations, by the people who participate in it, I think is one of the great signposts of the United States of America and the West in general. I think we're at the epitome of that. And that's a very exciting part of medicine and being on a team of persons who are there not because they have to be, not because it's a good living, as you said earlier, but not because it's a religious conviction necessarily, also, although some people do have that feeling as their main rationale, but instead because it's the thing that we can do that gives us the greatest satisfaction. God, I'm sounding like an awful preacher in a way, but I'd like to share that excitement of that because I've never gotten over that excitement, and I couldn't help writing about it. Pat,
it definitely came through. I definitely caught that in your writing, and I picked up your enthusiasm too over the years because a few years ago I was invited to help a European eye bank to get accredited in the American system.
Yeah.
And when I went over there, they said, well, you know, we can't offer you anything. I said, I didn't ask for anything. I'm here because this is what we do. The eye banks help each other. And I think sometimes that generosity is confusing to places outside of the U.S. to know that this is what nonprofits do. We help one another.
That's absolutely right. And now there's a sort of a group of those eye NGOs together under Vision 2020, the Right for Sight, and I think that increasingly, when you say together, increasingly, I think there's a collaborative or togetherness about the effort worldwide of trying to eradicate world blindness. Of course, you can never do it perfectly, but my gosh, river blindness is but coming under control. That's a terrible worm disease of leads to blindness and many other complications. Trachoma, which you mentioned earlier, Larry, you mentioned, is infectious disease. And I tell in my book about how trachoma was treated in 1948 with an electric needle and a completely unscientific method in Iran. That was my first overseas ophthalmological mission with my father. I was far from an ophthalmologist in 1948. But gradually, the truth is out and the systems develop, and to see that happen in one's lifetime, that a disease, the commonest cause of blindness in the world, trachoma, has now become rare. It's not existent in the United States anymore, but rare in many of the countries in which it was just as bad as almost as common as the common cold. It was that in Saudi Arabia when I first was there. Anyway, I don't mean to rave on in this excited way, but I do get excited about our specialty. I can tell some funny stories, but I think I have a feeling that now it's getting a little bit late. As I look at it, we've been chatting away here, and I've been interrupting you for about the first 30 minutes, and I don't know how many more. What do either of you have that you really feel like we should say that we haven't said? Anything special?
I'd like to point out that the multiculturalism and international volunteer effort is shared by many people in our own culture in the United States, but many other countries have also participated, particularly Western Europe, Australia, Japan, and many other countries that have the resources to assist. And in 1999, Médecins Sans Frontières, an organization based in France of volunteer physicians, not just ophthalmologists, but all specialties, won the Nobel Peace Prize. And that was the highest recognition internationally, of course, it could be given to volunteerism. And I think it's important for the listeners to know that medicine is in a sort of a crisis mode with its financial underpinning, with Medicare threatened in our own country. But we still have a very advanced healthcare system that will be in some degrees supported, and it will carry on. But the listeners should also bear in mind that many countries do not have such a system and go without healthcare, and particularly in our own specialty without eye care, and remain blind because of it.
The thing I would add, David, is just for your listeners also to realize that they can get involved and, you know, pick their favorite nonprofit. Contact Orbis and see what they can do to get involved with the organization, or contact the iBank and see what they get involved with the organization. There are plenty of nonprofit organizations that welcome involvement from interested individuals, and they can share in the spirit that you express in your book.
That's so true. You know, I don't know if it still is feasible as it was for me, but I've been around the world quite a number of times and in many places of the world, particularly in developing nations, a lot. And to my memory, I've never paid for those trips myself. I've been either on a job or I was hired to do it. I was paid for by the Helen Keller International or the NIH. International Eye Foundation, or Care Medico, or I even had a grant from NIH with permission to operate in Jordan for a while. If one has the initiative and the determination to serve in those capacities like that, then there's always an answer. It just depends on the intensity of one's desire to do it. At least I think it depends on that as the first step. So I want to just thank Pat Dahl for being with us, Patricia Dahl for being with us, one of the icons of modern-day eye banking. And I want to, of course, thank also Larry Schwab, who, as I said, is one of the greatest persons known in global ophthalmology, which is an increasingly important recognition that's going on in the world now. People are beginning to think in terms of global ophthalmology as a subspecialty almost. And to that end, Orbis has recently made a decision that there would be a David Payton, I love that, a David Payton fellowship in global ophthalmology. And I get the I have the luck of raising money to try to endow it. So on my website, which is Second Sight Views from an Eye Doctor's Odyssey, there will be, not now, but there will soon be two opportunities. One is find out how you get the book, if somebody wants to buy the book or get it in the e-book. And the second opportunity is if they want to find out more about this fellowship in global ophthalmology and they want to contribute to it, the website will say that. So it's a twofer, this website. So thank you both for enlivening this discussion and being the guts of the information that we've conferred on people who may tune in. And I want to also thank Rare Bird Lit for helping in the marketing of this book. Thank Tyson Cornell and Christina Galante. And I would like also to say how grateful I am to the editor of my book, whose name is Nancy Harden. And just for those of you who like to meet on meetings like this on 3 p.m. on Tuesdays, next Tuesday I'm going to be in a conversation with Nancy Harden about how my book got together and how this very intelligent, wise, powerful person was able to make my book into something that was readable from my own scrawl and my disorganization and so on, and pulling it together. So, if you care, tune in again next week at this time. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, David.
Yes.
Thank you, David.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.